As I mentioned already, the book of Job primarily is a cycle of conversations between Job and his so-called friends. Eliphaz was the first to speak up in chapters 4 and 5, and then Job answers him in chapter 6 and 7. Bildad speaks up in chapter 8, and then Job responds to him in chapters 9 and 10. Then, as we saw last Sunday, Zophar, he speaks up in chapter 11. Job responds to him in chapters 12 through 14. And together we've already walked through this first cycle, but Job's friends are not yet finished. Zophar says what is on his mind, and Job answers that in great declaration of faith. You'll remember he said to Zophar last Sunday night, "Though God slay me, yet will I trust in him." I mean, he declares his faith regardless of what Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar has to say. And as soon as Job gets done saying this, it's as if Eliphaz speaks up and says, "Oh, and by the way, I have something else to say. Something else on my mind that I've thought about since Bildad and Zophar have been saying it." And he doesn't even ask, "If you will, I'd like to say it." He just says, I'm gonna say it. And that's where we are as we come to chapter 15. Eliphaz has spoken, Bildad has spoken, Zophar has spoken, and Eliphaz says, "Well, there's something else I want to say." And essentially, the entire conversation that Job's friends are having with him can be summarized like this. They're saying to him that all suffering, every bit of it, is caused by sin. And in addition to that, here's what they're saying. That because you're suffering, Job, you are a terrible sinner. Now again, it is true that Job is a sinner, as we all are. None of us would negate the truth that we are sinners before God. But the problem with these arrogant accusations is that Job's suffering is not a result of any particular rebellion against God. But his friends wouldn't see it any other way. And so what do they choose to do? Let him have it. I like how Job describes these three men in chapter 16 and verse number 2 when he says, "Miserable comforters are ye all." It fits perfectly, doesn't it? Because according to Job chapter 2, way back several weeks ago, in Job chapter 2 and verse number 11, these three men had come to sympathize with and to comfort Job in his suffering, but they had done neither of these things. Instead of comforting him, they have only troubled him. And by the time Eliphaz speaks up for the second time, by which Bildad will follow, and then Zophar is going to throw his two cents in one more time, it's just more of the same, more of the same. They're nothing more than miserable comforters to Job. And so I'm going to give you a lot of backdrop, a lot of information, and then I'll conclude it with three points, as you'll see there in your notes. Let's go to chapter 15. Eliphaz is speaking here. We see that in verse number 1. "Then answered Eliphaz." He's saying a lot of things, but essentially we see it summarized in verse number 6. Look at verse number 6. "Eliphaz says to Job, thine own mouth, Job, condemneth thee, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee. Job, we're not the problem. You're the problem." Now, Job has answered this beautifully. He's said in each one of their first cycle of conversations, his faith in God. He's even admitted his lack of faith at times, how that some days he's doing great and some days he doesn't even want to live. But one thing is certain, Job is standing strong, the best that he can in his faith. And all that Eliphaz wants to say is, "Job, we're not the problem. You are the problem." And then he goes down to verse number 7 and says, "Art thou the first man that was born, or wast thou made before the hills?" He goes on in verse 8, "Hast thou heard the secret of God, and dost thou restrain wisdom thyself? What knowest thou that we know not, Job? What do you understand, which we don't understand?" Verse 9, verse 10, "With us are both the gray-headed and the very aged men, much older than your father." major problem with Eliphaz is that he's so prideful and arrogant that he is deceived of his own shortcomings. I read a verse this week in Obadiah. The minor prophets are wonderful few books to read and understand, especially contextually in a generation in which you and I live in, to remind ourselves that God will bring judgment. That God will exercise his wrath on a sinful people. But in Obadiah, I was reminded of the problem with so many of us today. Obadiah 1:3 says this, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee." The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. It's a dangerous place to be when your heart is so filled with pride that you can't even see your own problems. Instead of the sermon being a sermon that I can learn from, the sermon was about somebody else. Instead of the scripture being words that God could use in my life, I can think of someone who can really use it. Job, this is not about us. This is about you. Pride so much in a person's heart that they can't even see that they're the problem. And that's where Eliphaz is. Arrogantly. Using even, verse 10, his age and his experience to try and prove how much wiser he was than Job. I'm not negating the fact that with age does come wisdom. The book of Proverbs tells us that. Not to discard the wise, the aged men. Paul told Timothy that the church ought to always respect its elders. Why? Because elders have life experience. They can teach us so much about God. But if you think for a minute your experience and your age that you can just toss around like a bunch of weight thinking you know better than everybody else, that is pride, my friend. And that's what Eliphaz is saying. He's saying, I'm older. I want to remind you, Job, I'm older than your daddy is. Best if you listen to me. I think I know God a little better than you do. I think I've had some experiences in life that you have never experienced. And the sad thing is sometimes in life we are just as prideful. We think our education, we think our background, we think our experience, our intellect, our age is something that automatically makes us have the ability to tell people what we think of them or how much better they should do something or whatever the case may be. That is exactly what Eliphaz is doing. And he just continues this throughout the remainder of the chapter. Look at verse number 17. He says, I will show thee, hear me, and that which I have seen I will declare, which wise men have told from their fathers and have not hid it. If you'd listen to me, you'd find wisdom, Job. Job responds when you come to chapter 16. In fact, his response is in chapter 16 and 17. And here's the summary of what Job answers in response to Eliphaz's arrogance. In verse number 12, Job acknowledges the deep despair and suffering that God has allowed upon his life. Look at verse 12. I was at ease. Everything was going great. Isn't that how it is when suffering comes knocking on your door? Everything's going great. I mean, I got up like I did every day. It was going to be a beautiful day. I was at ease, verse 12. But he, God, hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by my neck. He hath shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. That's how Job is feeling right now. Everything was going good, but it just felt like God has grabbed me by the neck and he has shaken me so much that I have nothing even left to feel. He's acknowledging his deep despair. Look at verse number 20. He says, my friends scorn me, but mine eye poureth out tears unto God. He says here, this intense pain that I have on top of my suffering is a result of you, my friends. Instead of helping me, you have scorned me, but my eyes are pouring out, begging for relief, begging for grace, asking God to bring me through this. And then when you come to chapter 17 and verse number 1, he hits a very low point. Verse 17 and 1 says, my breath is corrupt, my days are extinct, the grave are ready or is ready for me. I do believe that Job wanted to live long enough to be vindicated, but he wasn't sure how much more he could endure. Which is why he says in verse number 1, my days are numbered. It's as if my grave is already ready. Now, you need to understand this about Job. Not one time, even in these low, low moments, does he ever consider taking his own life. Never. Never once. But he was ready to go if God willed. Now, be careful how you answer. But have you ever really been to that point? I'm not sure that any of us can truly empathize until we are. That I don't know how much more I can take. God, it just feels, has taken me up by his hands and shaken me until nothing's left. I'm just lifeless. My days are numbered. They're preparing the grave for me. If God takes my life today, I'm okay with that. Friend, this is a very low point. And you have to wonder if he would have ever gotten this low had it not been for those miserable comforters. It's true, isn't it? Now, Bildad speaks up. Eliphaz has said what was on his mind. You get to chapter 18, and Bildad speaks. Verse 1, chapter 18. Then answered Bildad. Let me tell you something about Bildad as you learn here in chapter 18. He's mad and he's vicious. He's mad and he's vicious. Job has just said, I don't know how much more that I can take. I feel like the grave is ready for me to fall in. Bildad's not hearing that. There's not even the slightest sensitivity to Job's pain, and yet he calls himself a friend. In fact, I don't know if you'll find stronger language from any of the friends than what you find here in chapter 18. We'll look at it briefly, and then we're going to spend the remainder of our time in chapter 19. Look at verse number 2, chapter 18. Bildad says, how long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, and afterward we will speak. In other words, Job, why don't you just shut up and let us talk? Can you believe this? Can you believe this? Even after going through all of those conversations at the beginning, Job says, I don't know how much more than I can take. You're my friends, and all you've done is scorn me. I'm ready to die if it's the will of God. And then his friend has the audacity to speak up and say, shut up, Job, and listen to what we have to say to you. Look at verse number 4. He teareth himself in his anger. Shall the earth be forsaken for thee, Job? Shall the rock be removed out of his place? Job, do you want God to rearrange the entire earth for you? Is that what you want, little Job? He's babying him, making him feel desolate for even acknowledging the despair that he's feeling. As if it was wrong to say that he wants God's grace. As if it was wrong to ask God to bring him through. Bildad is saying, "You, is that what you want, Job? Are you having such a hard little time, Job, that you'd like God to stop everything he's doing and rearrange the entire world because of your little problems, Job?" Verse 5, "Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out, and the spark of his fire shall not shine." Be careful, Job. That's what he's saying. Bildad's saying, be careful, Job. God destroys the wicked. Be careful, Job. You know, when you said that grave is ready, you might get what you want, because God has no problem destroying the wicked. And all the way down through verse number 16, Bildad says to Job in this long paragraph, and Job, he's probably going to just kill you. That's probably what's going to happen. Look at it, verse 16. His roots, he's speaking of Job, Bildad saying of Job, his roots shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off. Job, God destroys the wicked, and it looks like that's what he's going to do to you. Verse 17. It's as if he's speaking to his friends now. Look at him. Verse 17. His remembrance shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street. Job, you're going to die, and no one will ever remember you again. Aren't you glad you don't have friends like this? My word. Job, you're going to die, and nobody's ever going to remember you again. Look at verse 18. He shall be driven from light into darkness. He shall be chased out of the world. God is going to chase you out of this world, Job. Verse 19, he shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day. They that went before will be affrighted. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked. And this is the place of him that knoweth not God. In other words, Job, the truth of the matter is, when God does chase you out of the world's just going to be better without you. That's what he's saying. Surely, verse 21, such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God. Your son, your nephew, nobody in your house, nobody will come after you. They won't be affrighted anymore. It'll be a better place when you are dead. I heard a preacher recently use the phrase in relation to people like this. He called them pompous quacks. I like that. In fact, I've been calling everybody this week, you pompous quack. Let me tell you what Bildad is. A pompous quack. It's no wonder when you open up chapter 19 and read Job's response that he is absolutely crushed. Wouldn't you be? If you had a friend to say things like this to you in the darkest day of your life, wouldn't you be crushed? Can I remind you, these are no friends at all to Job. In fact, it's oftentimes in the darkest days of our lives that we discover who our real friends are. That's why Proverbs tells us that a brother loveth at all times. A friend is born out of adversity. You go through adverse sufferings of life, you'll find out who your real friends are. These are no friends of Job. This is when he responds in chapter 19. Look at what he says in verse 1. Then answered Job and said, how long will ye vex my soul and break me into pieces with words? You are crushing me. How long will you keep doing this? How long will you continue to say these things? Your words are breaking me into pieces. And that's why I say, would Job have ever gotten to this low point had it not been for these men? Yes, he acknowledged that God had shaken him. Now he's saying, I'm in this position because of you. It ought to remind all of us, whether we're going through suffering or not, we ought to be very careful with how we use our words. As we've illustrated so many times, the tongue is like a hammer. A hammer can be used in multiple ways. We can use it to build something great. We can use it to tear something down. Be careful how you use your words. Colossians chapter 4 tells us that our speech, our words, are to be always with grace, seasoned with salt. That is, our words must be filled with grace and encouragement, especially to the hurting. And I have not denied for one time in this study that yes, oftentimes our sin and rebellion bring suffering and consequences onto our lives. I don't think any of us who follow God and have any little bit of knowledge would deny the fact that yes, sin does bring consequences. But even in those moments where God would need us to be a Nathan to a David and rebuke and bring back to the place of right relationship with God, even in those moments, it is very important how we use our words. Our words ought to be always graceful, encouraging, comforting, especially to the hurting. Your words have vexed me. Job goes on speaking like a man who is indeed crushed. In fact, verses 13 through 21 might be the lowest point of Job's suffering that we've seen thus far. If you thought chapter 17 was bad, look at what he says here. Go down to verse number 13. Job says, he hath put my brethren, chapter 19, verse 13, he hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintances are estranged from me. That is, my friends have walked out on me. Look at verse 14. My kinsfolk have failed and my familiar friends have forgotten me. My family has walked out on me. Look at verse 15. They that dwell in mine house and my maids, they count me for a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. I called my servant and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. That is, those that have even worked for me, that know me best, they don't even acknowledge me. They don't even want to look at me when I walk by them. This is terrible. Friends have left me. Family has left me. Those that I've given opportunities to don't even acknowledge me. Verse 17, my breath is strange to my wife. I got a kick out of that this week. I read that and I thought to myself, my breath is strange to my wife. I know exactly how he feels. There's been many times I've said, good morning, sweetheart, and she'll be like, go brush your teeth, please. Now, he's not talking about bad breath. But there is a sad element to this. There is a sad element. Look at what he says. My breath is strange to my wife, though I entreated for the children's sake of my own body. What he's saying is that I am even repulsive to my own wife. This is sad. Verse 18, yea, young children despise me. I arose and they spake against me. In other words, children taunt me. Verse 19, all my inward friends, what's the difference them inward friends and regular friends? Friends would be acquaintances. Friends we have 300 people in our church, and all 300 of you are my friends. But then there are inward friends, right? I mean, there are close companions, best friends, so to speak. That's what Job is saying. My inward friends, they abhor me. Those whom I loved are turned against me. My best friends, even my best of best friends, have turned against me. Look at this, verse 20. My bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh. I am escaped with the skin of my teeth. Have pity upon me. Have pity upon me. Oh, my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. You know what he's saying? My bone cleaveth to my skin. I'm hanging on by a thread. I'm hanging on by a thread. Verse 21, have pity on me. I don't think I'm going to make it. Now, here's what I want us to highlight. Because when you come to verse 23, everything changes. Job has sunk to the lowest of lows. The grave is ready for me. Your words have crushed me. You've done nothing but scorn me. My family, my friends, people who know me, they've all walked away. Even my wife doesn't want to be with me. I'm hanging on by a thread. I don't think I can take it. And then you come to verse 23. And you find in just a moment, he goes from the lowest of lows to soaring to the highest of highs. Now, we've discussed this a lot with Job because suffering in all of our lives, it brings great lows, but they also produce tremendous highs. And in each one of Job's responses to his friends, you see him in a low point, and then you see him rise to a mountain of faith. Then you see him back low again, and you see him rise to a mountain of faith. This ought to encourage you, Christian. Because all of us, just like Job, according to God, that there was no one like him in all the earth, an upright man, one that feared God, one that hated evil. I mean, this is a godly, godly man. Even he had the up and downs, the up and downs, the up and downs. I want to say to you tonight, some of you are here and you are discouraged and you are beaten down. And it feels like, Pastor, last week I was up here. This week I'm down here. I'm just no good. Yes, you are. Hold on. God is doing a work in your life. We've been where you're at, and we'll be back where you're at. We all have those days where we could charge hell with a water gun. We all have those days where we don't even feel like we can go back to the assembly of believers. All of us have those high moments and low moments. Don't feel like you're alone. Don't put yourself in that place. We are just like Job in that respect. Up and down, back and forth, stepping out on faith. Staying in the boat, thinking it's all going to work out, thinking it's all going to fall apart. I could live another decade. Lord, won't you take me right now? Oh, I can't wait to see what my kids turn out. I feel like I'm going to have to bail them out of jail. I mean, it's back and forth. It's back and forth. It's back and forth. So it is with all of us. And I think in those moments of discouragement is when we really start looking at ourselves in a different light than what God sees us. I'm a failure. I'm not a good Christian. Look at me. Can I say something to you? You're not as bad as you think you are. Because the way that you see you is not the way that God sees you. God doesn't see you for who you are today. He sees you for what he wants to make you. What he wants to teach you, what he wants to bring to you. See, Job doesn't realize it yet, but if he'll just hold on, he's going to get everything back and more. Amen. Truly, the happiest days of his life, if we can even fathom it, are ahead. He's up and down. What Job is fixing to say here in chapter 19 is another strong statement of faith that is etched in the hearts of generations of believers. It's going to be familiar to you if you haven't read it already. And that's the thing about suffering. I think it's often true that Christians who go through seasons of suffering, especially intense suffering, are those whom God uses to impact others in transformational ways because of their faith that has risen during the lowest moments of their life. We know people like that, don't we? We worship people like that. I think of Mike Sharon, who was the lowest of lows, yet he never failed to encourage. I learned so much from Mike's faith in those dark days. I think of Chris and Stephanie. Every time Chris gives me an update on Stephanie, he is always so positive, so godly, so spirit-filled. That doesn't mean they're not scared. But oftentimes when you go through intense suffering, God uses you in transformational ways. I think of the Ziglars and how I've told Caitlin's story all over the world, preaching about forgiveness and how I saw you forgive that young boy who was reckless that night. When I stood in the courtroom and read that out loud, and I've told that story everywhere I've preached, and I've watched people respond to their faith in a low moment of life, people you don't even know. That's what we see with Job. That oftentimes those who go through intense suffering rises with great faith that God uses to transform other people's lives. That's why I said this morning it's so important. You may not think anybody's watching. You may not realize they're listening, but they are. And they're learning from you how to handle suffering. Oh, notice what he says in verse 23. Job says, "Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book." In other words, what I'm fixing to say, I wish someone would write it down and put it in a book. Isn't it interesting that God answered his prayer? Here it is. It's not just in a book. It is in the book. We have everything about Job. Job says, "I just want y'all to write this down. You need to remember it. Put it in your iPad or something. I'm fixing to say something good," Job says. He's at a high moment, verse 24. "That they were graven," that is these words, "I wish that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in a rock forever." What I'm fixing to say, I want somebody to chisel on a rock. I want it to be seen and read forever. Do you think he might have been speaking of his tombstone? Perhaps figuratively. Tombstones as we know it today. When I'm dead and gone, this is what I want people to remember about my suffering. Oh, this is good. Here's the three things he says. Fill in the blanks and we'll be dismissed. Number one, what was so important that he thought needed to be written down, that he wants chiseled on a rock to be seen and read forever. Here's the first thing he does. He speaks of confidence in his Redeemer. He speaks of confidence in his Redeemer. Look at verse 25. "For I know that my Redeemer liveth." I know, I'm confident that though I am going through the darkest day of my life, my Redeemer, he lives. This was both a personal and a peaceful declaration of confidence. It was personal in the sense that Job knew he belonged to God. He didn't just say, "I know a Redeemer liveth." No, "my Redeemer liveth." In the dark days of your life, you need to remind yourself every once in a while, "I belong to God. I belong to God. I don't belong to man. I don't belong to my sufferings. I don't belong to those friends who scorn me. I don't belong to those who despise me. No, I belong to God. I know that my Redeemer liveth, peaceful, not only personal, but peaceful in the sense that because his Redeemer lives, all is well with his soul." All is well with his soul. Of course, we know the Redeemer is Jesus Christ. "And those who belong to him need not fear nor worry about the future." This is salvation from sin. This is peace in chaos. This is confidence in suffering. He speaks of his Redeemer that lives. "I know that my Redeemer liveth." Confidence in his Redeemer. Secondly, he speaks of assurance of God's sovereignty. Assurance of God's sovereignty. I said it last week, one of the greatest things you could ever know about God is his sovereignty. That he is in control of all things. Job said, "Not only do I know," look at it, verse 25, "not only do I know that my Redeemer lives, but that also he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth." When it's all said and done, that's what he means by the latter day. When it's all said and done, Jesus Christ, my God, will stand on this earth and he will make all things right. He will vindicate. He will bring justice. He will prove his sovereign lordship to all people. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. He will step foot on this earth and he will make all things right. I know that, Job says. I know that. I'm assured of that. As God is in control of the future, he is in control also of my present distress. Oh, this is beautiful. He speaks of confidence in his Redeemer. He speaks of assurance of God's sovereignty. Thirdly, he speaks of the realization of his future. He speaks of the realization of his future. Notice what he says in verse 26, "And though after my skin worms destroy this body." Kind of a gross, vivid picture of death, isn't it? And obviously things are a little different today as they were then. We have a little more helpful way in going about preserving the body, helping when death comes. A lot of times they just put them in a rock, chisel out a rock out of the side. That's why we see the tomb of Christ being exemplified the way it is. Sometimes in the ground as we are, but oftentimes on the side of a mountain where they would just lay bodies. No proper embalming process. And so what Job is saying by the worms coming and eating his flesh, he's saying, long after I'm dead and gone, long after I'm dead and gone, yet in my flesh, verse 26, I shall see God. Verse 27, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. What Job is saying is, when this body finally does die, I know, I shall see God. I shall see Him. Don't you long this evening for that day when you will see God face to face? I shall see Him. John tells us in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2 that we shall see Him as He is. There's coming a day that every believer in this room shall see God. We'll see Him when you're dead and gone, when the worms are eating the flesh, when it's all said and done, the last breath here, the first breath there, we'll be face to face with Christ my Savior. Do you have assurance of that future? I think that's so important that Job says this. Because even though in chapter 17 he felt like the grave was ready, he was assured that no matter when God chooses for me to go, oh, the blessed future is that I shall see Him face to face. Here's the other thing that's important about what Job's saying. Not only will Job see God, but when he sees God, he will see Him, verse 27, and not another. See Him and not another. It means that we will actually see God, not a stranger. In other words, when you lock eyes with Jesus, it will be the fulfillment of an already existing relationship. He will not be a stranger to you, and it is Him that you will actually see, not another. It doesn't mean that you won't see anybody else along the journey. The Bible is very clear that we will. But when it comes to God, you will actually see Him, and there'll be no reaching out of the hand and saying, nice to meet you. No, you've already met Him. He will be no stranger to you, and you will be no stranger to Him. It will be like nothing you will ever experience in 1,000 lifetimes. Job says, I know that my future belongs to a God who has redeemed me, to a God who is in control of me, to a God whom I will see, and He will not be a stranger to me. Why was this statement of great faith so important? Because essentially what Job was saying to his friends is that, hey, you guys can say what you want to say. You can believe what you want to believe, but know this. When I die, let it be said of me forever. Let it be written in a book. Let it be chiseled on my tombstone. Put it in a rock. I want everybody to know that God is my Redeemer, and that I trusted His sovereign purposes for my life, and that at that moment of my last breath, I saw Him face to face. It's a packed few chapters of wonderful lessons that I could not rehearse all in the conclusion, but I would say these two things and we'll pray. Number one, I think it's obvious. Don't be a miserable comforter. We got enough of those. We got enough of those. Be careful how you use your words. Be sensitive to the hurts of others. While it may be true, God might be teaching a lesson, that's not your place to tell them what that lesson is. What they need is encouragement that they're going to be okay. that God's going to bring them through this. That's the first thing we take. Don't be a miserable comforter. Here's the second thing. Have confidence in your Redeemer. Can we just be open? How many of you have had one of those low moments in your life? I'm raising both hands. Didn't feel like you could take much more. Don't be a slave to your circumstances. Don't be imprisoned by the naysayers. Don't allow discouragement and the suffering to dictate your future. Have confidence. Have assurance in Christ your Redeemer that you belong to Him. And that as His possession, He will always do what is right for me. And He will lead me as a shepherd leads his sheep by the still waters and through the valley of the shadow of death. I am safe following my shepherd. May God help us. Whether we're in that day today or may that day come tomorrow, that we'll understand that in the lows and the highs, God will see us through.